Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. As lawmakers approach their town meeting break, a number of tax issues are being considered at the State House. Governor Peter Shumlin wants to impose a 0.7% payroll tax on all businesses to raise money that can be used to increase Medicaid reimbursement rates for healthcare providers. Shumlin says the money will be used with matching federal funds to reduce the so-called Medicaid cost shift. The governor says his plan will help lower private health insurance premiums by 5%.
Let's insist that any method that we come up with to pull down the federal dollars to fund this in a tax to Vermonters gets returned to the people who pay it. We are so sure that we can get this money back to the businesses and individuals who pay it with a 5% premium decrease over what they otherwise would have paid that we're willing to put in a law. The Green Mountain Healthcare Board will audit this annually, and if we don't get the money back to the people who pay it, it sunsets.
Well, if the payroll tax is implemented, the governor, lawmakers, and businesses are asking Green Mountain Care Board Chairman Al Gobay to guarantee this 5% reduction in private premiums. But Gobay says it's impossible to make this guarantee.
And they're turning to me and saying, you know, can the board guarantee this? And again, I will say no. You know, that if that's the way, the only reason they would do this, then they shouldn't do it. I mean, you cannot, in such a complicated part of our economy, guarantee something like that.
Will lawmakers support this payroll tax? If the answer is no, are there other options on the table to reduce the cost shift? These are some of the questions we have for our guests today, two people who study tax policy all year long, House Ways and Means Chairwoman Janet Ansel and Senate Finance Chairman Tim Ash. Great to have you here. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you for having us.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you have some thoughts about the governor's plan to impose a 0.7% payroll tax to help reduce the Medicaid cost shift. What about, as lawmakers look at that $112 million budget gap, maybe there's need for new revenue there? Nobody likes higher taxes, but are there some taxes that you would be willing to increase to pay for certain programs? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can always email us at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Representative Ansel, your committee has taken a fair amount of testimony on the governor's payroll tax plan. What are your thoughts about this proposal? Is it feasible? Is it a good idea?
We've had quite a lot of testimony. We've looked specifically at the payroll tax just as a source of revenue, and then we've also looked at the connection between the payroll tax and the increase in Medicaid reimbursement rates and the question about sort of the tape that you played, whether we can say with any confidence that that money is going to go back in some equitable way to the people who paid it. And we haven't taken a poll in the committee. We haven't had a vote. I'd say committee members are not yet convinced. The payroll tax proposal is still on the table, partly because we're at a point in the session where it doesn't make sense to take anything off the table. But there are certainly some concerns and some questions about it. One of the issues with the payroll tax is that it's a brand new tax that it will require. I think it's $3.5 million just to implement it, just to make it work. And then there's some operating costs going forward in terms of collecting it. And so that's just one of many things that we would need to look at. But I think the bigger concerns have been more in this question about whether the money goes back in an equitable way to the people who pay it. And we're still looking at it. I know people want me to say it's dead. It's not. It's actually still alive in the committee, and we'll continue to look at it and continue to work at it.
Do you think there's a commitment to deal with the cost shift to increase the Medicaid reimbursement rates if not with the payroll tax, then perhaps with another tax source?
Well, I've been watching, obviously, fairly closely what's been going on in our in the Healthcare Committee, which is the Policy Committee on Healthcare, and they will be making a recommendation to increase those reimbursement rates. We won't necessarily defer completely to them because there is a connection between the revenue and the reimbursement rates. But we obviously will take the work they do seriously, and it will help guide the discussion in my committee. So is there a commitment in my committee? I don't think I would describe it as a commitment. I think people's minds are open about whether that's a good use of revenue.
Senator Ash, what do you think about this payroll tax idea?
Well, one of the challenges in evaluating the proposal from the administration is that the goal that the administration has articulated is returning in aggregate terms the amount of new payroll tax paid back in reduced premiums. But of course, people don't live their lives in aggregate terms. They live their lives as one company or one individual. And so the closer you look at the proposal, the more you realize that there will be many, many businesses. In fact, most businesses will pay more. Only a small subset will pay less once you've returned back the proceeds of this cost shift reduction proposal. So that's something that I think as the employer community and as individuals start looking at and evaluating how it will affect them at the single firm level, it makes it presents some of the same challenges that a single-payer universal finance system was going to present in terms of a larger payroll tax.
What about this whole idea of dealing with the cost shift? A lot of attention now this year as a way, the governor says, to help reduce private health insurance premiums. Do you think it's an issue that should be dealt with?
Well, we have to look back a few years ago when we passed Act 48. The motivating factor for most legislators about passing a universal health care bill was to provide coverage to the uninsured, to improve the coverage of people who are underinsured, and to bring cost containment into the system. There are some of us who are somewhat worried that this proposal, when we think about it in terms of our healthcare economy, it feeds the beast. Some of us would like to put the beast on a diet. And so we're still unconvinced that this isn't just adding more dollars into a system that we're actually, I think, almost unanimous across the legislature in saying needs to be reined in.
If you'd like to join the conversation here, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. We're talking about the payroll tax. We're going to be looking at the income tax and perhaps a sugar-sweetened beverage tax. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Scott in Pomfret. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob. My question for your guest is, assuming that the payroll tax doesn't happen, it turns out not to be practical, will the legislature look in some of the other obvious places to reduce the cost shift? And one of them that I can think of is a report that the Green Mountain Care Board published last August about price variances and how in a lot of categories, for example, surgical visits, the variances between providers just simply couldn't be, a great deal of the differences couldn't be explained. And so to me, that suggests that there are some inefficiencies that perhaps if they were looked at might result in some savings that might result in lowering the cost shift and private premium. So I don't see a lot of attention being paid to that, and I'd be curious whether the legislature is going to take a look at that.
Well, we took some testimony on that in our committee, and I suspect that Tim did as well in his. But the question, and there are these variations do exist. It's one of the reasons why the cost shift conceptually makes sense. It's very hard to make it actually work because there is, for instance, a price differential between hospital-based physicians and independent practices in many instances. So what I believe is the case is the Green Mountain Care Board has the authority to look at those kinds of variations, has had it for a bit, but has not exercised that authority so far. It's a little bit out of the area of jurisdiction in my committee, but it's certainly something that we've considered and may make some sense. Now, whether that by itself is sufficient to address the cost shift in the sense that some people think that we should do. I'm not sure, but I do think that it makes sense to look at those variations no matter what.
Well, and our whole healthcare system is built on a pricing methodology which is artificial and makes no sense. Some of the reason for these variations, whether it's between hospitals or independent practices, is that over time budgets have been approved which allow people to charge more for one service versus another. And then once it's built into the budget, it just persists and grows. One example would be an independent practice that provides primary care. If it's independent, it might get paid by the insurer $100 per 15-minute visit for a checkup. If the next day that same practice is purchased by the University of Vermont Medical Center, the insurer may pay $150 or $160 for the exact same visit. Now, just the name on the paper of ownership of that practice has just added $60 to $70 for the exact same service. No new utilization, no new demand, and that's the type of thing that we need to root out.
Representative Ansel, the House Healthcare Committee is putting together its package dealing with the cost shift, dealing with increased Medicaid expansion. They're also looking at the sugar-sweetened beverage tax. That would raise about $35 million a year. They think that might be a good connection. What do you think?
We took that up in our committee last year in a similar context, and we actually had a vote in the committee on that proposal. Although I think it was a penny per ounce last year when we looked at it, this is 2 pennies per ounce. It's an excise tax, so it's paid by the distributor and presumably shows up in the cost of the product, similar to the tax on cigarettes, which is also an excise tax. The vote in my committee was 6-5 against. I was one of the five, so I was one of the people who supported doing the sugar-sweetened beverage tax. Didn't pass last year. I don't know whether the vote would be different in my committee this year. I continue to support it. I understand the connection between sugar-sweetened beverages and healthcare. And to me, that connection makes a difference to people. But it's really an uphill, it's certainly an uphill battle in my committee. And I haven't even really given much thought to whether it would be a similarly a difficult challenge on the floor. I suspect it might be.
Senator Ash, would you support a sugar-sweetened beverage tax if it was linked to healthcare spending?
Well, I think one of the challenges with that concept, Bob, is that you would then be linking a revenue source that you hope will decline to spending that we know will be consistent and growing into the future. So as a general rule, the Senate Finance Committee has avoided supporting ongoing operational costs of the state with declining revenue sources. I think it is clear there is some interest by some members in the Senate of taking a look at this issue. But other members have worries about the workability of the tax itself, the definition of what a sugar-sweetened beverage is, and whether there will be attempts to avoid by the distributors or the manufacturers of products. And then, of course, we also have a Senate that has at least half of its members along the New Hampshire border who have great concerns about whether the revenues would really come in quite as anticipated as people can go and buy several cases of soda in New Hampshire and then come back, things like that.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mike in Bennington. Hi, Mike. What's on your mind today?
Well, hi. I look at the never-ending debate in Montpelier and our local level of increasing taxes every year at the rate of sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 times the rate of inflation. Now, again, I'm a middle-class taxpayer. When we moved here a couple decades ago, Vermont was to be our home forever. But the annual dramatic increase in taxes have basically forced us to put everything on the market. We're selling, and we're going to have to move out. Where we're looking to move, we're looking at saving $10,000 a year in income taxes and property taxes for the same standard of living. And I think in the long run, when the people in Montpelier who seem divorced from the reality of the economic and geographical freedom we have to pack up and move, it's going to cost you in the long run. It's going to hurt Vermont in the long run. We've got a spending problem. We don't have a taxation problem.
Okay, Mike, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's go to Tim in Barnard. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. This sugar tax stuff is just another echoed effect of your last caller and everybody else's frustration. I agree with it. Taxing is not your way out of this entire problem across the nation. And if, let's just say, people, it is for the health care concern. If we take and tax on the sugar stuff, let's say everybody stops drinking soda and said, well, it's better for us, let's all drink bottled water, and you have another budget shortfall. Are we going to now tax water? And what is your reasoning? Is that now, well, now you're drinking healthy. What's your answer to that? I mean, we've got to stop this. Less regulations. Vermont needs to be more business friendly to provide jobs, so income taxes pay for the revenue that we need in taxes, not penalize people for budget shortfalls and bad administration across our Congress. Thanks
okay,
for the
Tim.
Call.
Tim, thanks very much. Senator Ash, Mike and Tim say we got a spending problem here that needs to be brought under control that doesn't need more taxation.
Well, Mike and Tim might be right that we have a spending challenge, and I think every member of the legislature has acknowledged that for years. I would not agree with their I'll loosely describe their sense that we're a bunch of drunken sailors in the legislature who can't find anything we don't want to spend money on. I would also disagree with the characterization of the great tax increases that are being originated in Montpelier. Most of what Mike and Tim are probably feeling are school spending pressures, which are local budget decisions where we merely raise the rate in order to collect the money in our statewide system. But what I really believe is missing when people like Mike and Tim talk about how we are spending beyond our means, because this is a theme that comes up and legislators hear it all the time, is that the means themselves have changed. Take just a few examples. We lose roughly $40 to $50 million a year on online purchases of goods because people do not pay the sales tax that's due. The legislature made no change to policy. It didn't decide to spend more, but we lose $40 to $50 million a year. The estate tax. We rely, and I wish we could undo this, but we rely to pay for general fund on the estate tax as one of the funding sources. What that really means is that in a given year, if some people who have a lot of money and really poor estate planning don't happen to die, we have revenue downgrades, which just happened. The most recent downgrade was almost entirely attributable to not enough wealthy people with poor estate planning passing away in this particular year. These are challenges that we increasingly face as our revenue sources become very volatile. The other last piece I'll just mention, it used to be that consumption in Vermont was about two-thirds on goods, one-third in services. We tax goods, we don't tax services. That equation has flipped. Now it's one-third goods, two-thirds services. So the economy and our behavior as Vermonters has changed. We have not changed the tax code to look ahead for the next 20 years so we don't have these $50 to $100 million challenges each year.
Today on the program, we're looking at a lot of tax issues being considered at the State House this year. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at tax issues at the State House. Our guest, Senate Finance Chairman Tim Ash, and House Ways and Means Chairwoman Janet Ansel. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Representative Ansel, I started looking at several different proposals that are being considered at the State House, and they all seem to need some money. It's an interesting situation where people perhaps agree on the policy that needs to be done, but there's huge disagreement on how to pay for it. There's the Medicaid cost shift that we were talking about earlier in the program. There's paying for the expansion of Medicaid itself, another 23,000 people who have been added to Medicaid. Then we have the cleaning up of Lake Champlain and other waterways. That plan is been proposed to have a 2-cent gas tax increase, 0.5% on the rooms and meals tax, perhaps a fertilizer tax. We have a $110 million budget gap that some people think is going to have to be a combination of spending reductions and new revenue. We've just learned this week that the transportation fund is short money because the price of gas has been so low, which is a good thing for a lot of people. But for the transportation fund, it might be an $8 million shortfall. So how do you deal with all these things at the same time? Because once you use a revenue source for one of them, it's not available for another.
Bob, you've described really well. If you add in the Ed Finance bill, the description you've just given is the work that my committee has in front of it when we get back from town meeting. It's all those bills. It's a real challenge how to balance those different needs. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do everything. The Clean Water Bill, I think, is a great example. We had a really, I think, inspiring presentation in the well of the House a couple weeks ago where everybody said, you know, we're all in on clean water. This is what we're going to do. I think we all know how important it is to address the issues in Lake Champlain and other fragile waterways in the state, but there really is no consensus on how to pay for it. And that's always the hard part. You know, the budget challenge, the $112 million or so budget gap, that's going to largely be resolved through reductions in spending. We will do some revenue for it, but it's most of it is going to be spending reductions. But the other things you've identified, clean water being, I think, an example where there's truly a consensus that we need to make changes. The healthcare, I think the consensus is a little less clear, but we've obviously made a commitment to the people that we've brought into the system that we need to pay for. The two callers earlier who said, you know, we're taxed enough, you know, that there's an aspect of what they said that I agree with. There are not limitless sources of revenue in this state. And so I think we, as we do the work that you've described, I think we need to be really conscious of that.
We got this email, Senator Ash, from Anna in Weybridge, who wants to know, why not a carbon tax?
Well, that's a good question. Why not a carbon tax? Thanks for singling me out, Anna. You know, I think the short story on that is that there are so few jurisdictions in the United States that have gotten to the point where they're really contemplating a carbon tax that I'm not sure Vermont can afford to be on the bleeding edge of every single large-scale proposal. I think, you know, when you really look at the investments that the state has made in renewable energy, weatherization, some will say in each instance it may or may not have been enough. We are already raising revenues to provide tremendous contributions to reduction in climate change. And I think, so we don't call it a carbon tax, but in some way, the revenue that's being raised from people from existing revenue sources is participating in that way. There is an example, particularly British Columbia, that has probably the most sophisticated carbon tax policy, where they return any surplus funds back in as income tax reductions. People there seem to be pretty happy with it. But of course, that's Canada. We're in the United States. We're here in Vermont. So I think there will be a time when we have to look at these issues, particularly as people drive less and they switch to different fuel cars. The conversation is happening and policy will have to change. But I think it's too premature to settle on one large framework at this time.
Representative Ansel, we also have an email about nonprofit groups and property taxes. And it's an enormous number when you look at all the nonprofit groups. I mean, these could be schools, colleges, hospitals, churches, lots of different organizations not paying property taxes. Would it be fair to ask nonprofits to pay some percentage of their property tax?
Well, if you ask other property owners, they'd probably say yes. And if you ask the nonprofit organizations, I'm quite sure they would say no. And that's kind of the dilemma that we're always confronting in our committee. We've gone over those exemptions in our committee. I know the Senate Finance has done that work as well. It's just very, very difficult to take any one of those exemptions away. I think it's a good discussion. It's a really good question. We need to keep it open, but it just isn't easy to do.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to John in Montpelier. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I would like to ask, can we really afford the current use program?
All right. Representative Ansel, changes to current use?
We just voted a bill in the House that would toughen the penalty for withdrawing from current use. The land use change tax, that is a bill that's passed the House, I think, three times before. One time it was vetoed by the governor. The other two times it didn't pass the Senate. So we've done it. We've done it again. That's not quite the same thing as limiting the program, but it will actually result in some parcels being withdrawn from the program, we expect. And so it may reduce a little bit the number of acres and the cost of the program. The cost of the program is about $59 million a year. It is a lot of money, and the caller asks a very legitimate question. We get a lot for that money. But there, I think it's as I said, with the nonprofit exemption, it's one of those things that, given the times that we're in, that we really need to take a hard look at it. We also heard a proposal that would reduce the benefit that you get on current use if you post your land. It's another sort of tweak to the program that we haven't taken action on.
And Bob, I'd say Janet is exactly right that just like the growth in exempt properties, the growth in current use reflects one of the changes that's occurred around us. Vermont has, in the legislature, over the years, have had core functions of government that we deliver. They don't change all that much from year to year, and it hasn't changed much from decade to decade, but the sources of revenue have. So if property taxes are a primary funding source for our education tax system, and you see fewer and fewer properties paying, or in the case of current use, paying a lower rate, you're funding the exact same core services with fewer contributors in. So that's one of the dilemmas we're facing right now. And as Janet points out, just to current use in particular, you know, that $59 million, no one's broken the rules. It's a program that people are entitled to utilize if they live up to their end of their bargain. It's the price that we have determined in the past that we're willing to pay to have open landscape, foresters out in the, you know, out in the forest, and viable farms.
Representative Ansel, your committee is also looking at the income tax and the deductions in the income tax. A couple of years ago, there was a much larger and more comprehensive change that you were looking at. What's the focus this year?
Actually, we've been looking at the same proposal that we had last year that passed the House, and that was to cap deductions at 2.5 times the standard deduction. So we're looking at variations of that. We're looking at all the deductions. My feeling, and I think my committee agrees, that if we're going to raise revenue, we don't want to raise rates, but what we want to do is we want to look at what the base is, what those rates apply to, and make sure that we've thought really carefully about the sort of how the equity of those deductions and whether we can make a system that's more equitable by reducing the value of those. So that's really what we're looking at this year.
And how much money is potentially there if you put a 2.5 times cap on deductions? Is there a fair amount of money that could be raised that way?
It depends on there are different ways to construct it, but the short answer is yes.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Whitney in Warren. Hi, Whitney. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
So I had an idea here, and, you know, I hear all of the same conversations bounce around all the time about legalizing recreational marijuana in the state of Vermont. And my concept was this. I've seen it the way it was unrolled in Colorado, and I saw the way it was unrolled in California. And I also saw all of the downfalls that came along with that. And my idea and my concept, which I haven't heard kicked around, which I'd love to hear you guys discuss, would be, what if the state of Vermont became the retailers in the state of Vermont? So it wouldn't be privately owned dispensaries. You'd have 6 state-run dispensaries, one right next to the police barracks in Williston, one right next to the police barracks in Middlesex, and on down the line. And it would be like a Vermont state liquor store. I mean, you don't have Joe Bob's dispensary, you don't have Joe Bob's liquor store, you got state-run liquor stores. At that point, you could take all of the revenue from the retail side of that market and allocate all of that back to our state programs. You could fund single-payer tax or single-payer health care. You could eliminate Act 60. You could probably eliminate property taxes and build everybody a pool at that point. I'm just shooting from the hip. I've run some priests, you know, Vermonters don't drink Budweiser. So all of the farmers in the state would be able to come to the state with their produce or their product, and the state would be able to take all of that retail money. Any thoughts on that?
All right, Whitney, thanks very much for your phone call. Senator Ash, the RAND Corporation study actually looked at this question about having something like the state liquor stores, and they said this is a big problem to go that route because it's still against federal law, and to put state employees in a position where they're breaking federal law, at least the RAND Corporation thought that was a big problem.
And therein lies one of the challenges in the Senate right now. I think that model, if you leave out the part about being against federal law, is the most comforting to the majority of the members of the Senate. But because of the point you just make, it throws us back into contemplating more of a wide-open landscape. And I think right now the Senate, I don't have a 30-vote real count, real-time count, but I do not believe the votes are there to move forward this year on a marijuana bill to raise the types of revenues that were described.
Representative Ansel, is that something your committee has taken any testimony on this year?
We heard from the RAND Corporation when they presented their report. We haven't taken any testimony other than that. I think the consensus, I agree with Tim. I think people want to watch a little more of what's going on in Colorado and Washington and other states that have been on the frontier of this before we decide exactly how we would want to design a legalization and taxation system. I think it's probably inevitable that we will go in that direction at some point, but I don't think it's now.
Let's talk to John in Castleton. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Bob. I've got a proposal to pay for school funding. And I recently sent this to Shap Smith via his email request for funding ideas. And I've been kicking this around for about 15 years. And it's to introduce casinos to our ski areas and tax the proceeds at a rate sufficient to fund education. If we could solve the education funding problem, our economy would grow exponentially. And I know that Chef Smith and Governor Shumlin say this is a non-starter. However, I don't think they're in a position to rule out anything at this point in regards to the growth of the Vermont economy.
Okay, John, thanks very much for your phone call. Representative Ansel, we have a Vermont lottery that contributes about $20 million a year to the state education fund. What about casinos?
Well, having said that everything is on the table, I'm not sure that casinos are actually on the table. We've heard what has happened in other states. They compete with one another. They need to increase the kinds of games they offer. They need to increase the venues. They're constantly ramping up in order to avoid having other states cannibalize their revenue on casinos. And I was at a meeting this weekend with a woman, a senator from Connecticut, who was asked, did she regret ever starting with casinos in Connecticut? And she said, absolutely, yes. It was a mistake. I hope it's a mistake that Vermont doesn't also make.
Senator Ash, is there something short of going full-blown into casinos, and the Lottery Commission, for instance, had some ideas of how to expand their operations, electronic poker, all sorts of things that could go into bars and restaurants. Is that an option?
Well, it's an option, but one that I don't think should be considered. One of the things that people who live in Vermont ought to take for granted is that when you travel around, when you enter restaurants, when you go to bars, when you're at the supermarket, you don't have a cheap experience of seeing flashing lottery games trying to reel your money in everywhere you turn, which is the experience in some states. And I have to say, there's an interesting tie-in for the last couple calls about ski areas. There's a sense that some people believe that we need to put the marijuana dispensaries at ski areas and now casinos. I'm not sure why we've reached these conclusions about our skiing friends.
Well, in the coming weeks, there are going to be a lot of decisions made about Vermont's tax policies. I'd like to thank our guest today, Representative Janet Ansel, the chairwoman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and Senator Tim Ash, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Thank you both very much for coming by.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about Senator Bernie Sanders' possible run for the White House. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Senator Bernie Sanders recently spoke at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. about the key issues facing the country. It was also an opportunity for Sanders to outline the priorities he would pursue if he decides to run for president. Will he run? And if he does, will he be a candidate in the Democratic primary? With us now to examine these questions is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Eric, does Bernie Sanders' appearance at the Brookings Institution tell us that he is indeed gearing up for a presidential run?
I believe it does. And you add that to a few other things. He's scheduled to give another speech in Washington at the National Press Club. He also has been spending time traveling to early primary and caucus states, particularly Iowa and New Hampshire. And all of these things added together indicate to me that he's very seriously testing the waters and may very well declare himself a candidate for president sometime later this year.
So what do you think the key factors are that Sanders is considering right now about whether or not to run?
Well, the main thing is whether he can generate enough grassroots support and enough financial support from small contributions. Bernie has demonstrated in his reelection races for the Senate that he's able to raise well over $1 million, multiple millions of dollars, in small contributions from donors all over the country. And he would try to replicate that method in funding his presidential campaign, not to rely on PACs, not to rely on corporate donations, not to rely on donations from wealthy individuals, but $10, $25, $50, $100 contributions. And there are, I believe, a substantial number of people out there who would contribute to his campaign. He would also want to do well enough that he's not an embarrassment. I think he realizes that Hillary Clinton has all sorts of advantages and resources, but at the same time, he doesn't want to see her win the nomination through a coronation, that she should go through a competitive process. And he's testing to see whether he can generate enough interest in the issues that he finds important to be a credible opponent for Hillary Clinton on debate stages in Iowa, New Hampshire, and other early caucus and primary states next year.
You know, Eric, it reminds me somewhat of when Howard Dean ran for president in 2004, and he declared that he wanted to represent, quote, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Is it that wing of the party that is not particularly pleased with Hillary Clinton right now?
Well, I don't know what Dean meant, to tell the truth, by the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, but it's clear what Sanders means. Sanders believes that one of the major issues facing the United States is income inequality and the stagnation of middle-class incomes. And while he says that these trends have been exacerbated since the end of the Great Recession, they've really been in place for about 20 years, interestingly, since Bill and Hillary Clinton were last in the White House. And he argues that the Democratic Party has become increasingly dependent on contributions from corporations, wealthy individuals, and Wall Street over that same period. And Sanders argues that income inequality and the squeeze on the middle class threatens the American dream of one hoping for a better life for one's children, and that the corporate influence really raises questions about democracy in America. And he sees those two as connected issues. And that's what he talked about at Brookings. That's what he talks about in these events in Iowa and New Hampshire.
You know, at that speech at Brookings, he said he might run as a Democrat, but there are some people who are encouraging him to run as an independent. If he decides to run, do you think he'll run as a Democrat?
Yes, I think he'll run as a Democrat, although he does point out in his speeches that he has been in Congress now for 25 years as an independent, and that is by far the longest service in the House and Senate in American history of anyone who was not either a Democrat or a Republican. So he obtained support from outside the main political parties. But Bernie has also said that he does not want to be a spoiler. He doesn't want to do anything that would contribute to the election of a right-wing Republican presidential candidate, and there is a danger that running as an independent in the general election can do that. It's also very difficult to get access to the ballot as an independent in the general election. It's much easier to get ballot access in the Democratic primary. But I must say, and and listeners with a long memory will remember this. When Bernie Sanders was first elected mayor of Burlington in the 1980s, his principal opponents in Burlington were the established Democratic Party. And when he first talked about running for Congress in the late 80s, the Vermont Democrats tried to prevent him from being elected to that position. So there'd be a great deal of irony if now, as he's coming toward the end of his political career, Bernie Sanders seeks the presidency as a Democrat.
But if he wants to debate Hillary Clinton on some of these economic issues, he really needs to run as a Democrat, doesn't
he? That's right. And national press reports indicate that although Clinton is quite likely to run, she's going to probably delay announcing her candidacy, perhaps even as late as the summer. And so I think Sanders would prefer that she get in earlier so that debates can start to be held and he can be on a platform with her. Now, one can also make the argument that if Clinton has to debate Sanders late this fall and into the winter, that could make her a stronger presidential candidate in the general election. Because if she wins the primaries basically uncontested, she wouldn't have had to test her ideas against any other candidates in primary or caucus debates. So if Sanders is up there on the platform with her, and a couple of other people who are thinking about running, Jim Webb, a former senator from Virginia, and Mark O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, if Sanders and one or two other people are up there on the platform with her, that's going to force her to develop her ideas, defend them, articulate them, and arguably be a better candidate in the fall than she would be without this sort of opposition and competition in the primaries.
So if Sanders runs, will his candidacy put some pressure on Hillary Clinton to address these issues of income inequality?
Yes. He will certainly raise the issues of inequality. He'll raise the issues of corporate influence over the Democratic Party. Now, he has said, and he's pointed out, and this is correct, that he's never run a negative advertisement in all his years that he's been running for the House and Senate. And he said, as an individual, he admires Hillary Clinton, that she has a distinguished career in American politics, has accomplished a lot. He overlapped with her for a bit in the Senate. But what he's opposing is the approach to politics, the Democratic Party, economic issues, fundraising, and foreign policy issues that is represented by Hillary Clinton. So he's not attacking Hillary Clinton as an individual, but the policies for which she and her supporters in the Democratic Party stand.
And when it comes to foreign policy, Sanders makes it very clear that he does not want to send American troops back to Syria, back to Iraq. And yet Hillary Clinton seems to have a different point of view. Does Sanders become the peace candidate?
Sanders clearly would want a more restrained foreign policy than Hillary Clinton. And remember again, and this was a big issue for Hillary Clinton in the 2008 primary in Vermont, which she lost to Barack Obama in the state, was her vote in favor of the Iraq War back in 2003. So Sanders would bring that up. But I think he would bring it up in the context of President Obama's recent request for a new authorization for the use of military force against the Islamic State, and Sanders and the concerns of not just Sanders but other Democratic senators about how that authorization can be couched and constrained so that the United States does not end up in an endless war, a quagmire, and a repeat of the situation that we were in 10 to 15 years ago.
So, Eric, Bernie Sanders says he'll make a decision maybe in the next month or two. What does your gut tell you? Is Bernie Sanders going to run for president?
Yeah, my guess is he will, that he'll concentrate particularly on Iowa and New Hampshire. Those primaries and caucuses will be in February of next year. And then I think the question becomes, how much staying power does his campaign have after that? How does he do in these early states, and how much longer can he remain in the race? I think he would very much like to remain in the race through the Vermont primary, which will be on town meeting day in 2016. And indeed, I would not be surprised if Bernie Sanders were to defeat Hillary Clinton in the Vermont primary in March of 2016. So I think he will announce a candidacy, and I think he'll remain a candidate through January, February, and early March of 2016.
It's going to be fascinating to see if he runs or not. Retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That's it for today. Monday on the program, we'll talk about new ideas to revitalize town meeting, from serving a pie to engaging citizens online. Some communities are taking steps to boost attendance at their annual meeting. Send your ideas on how to improve town meeting to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Rick Sangari. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.